glad, folks. Go ahead and just clarify what we're doing here. Obviously, our midweek service, we've dubbed it Ask Jeff. What drives this is not me. What drives this is you. And almost every single day, we're receiving questions on Facebook, we're receiving questions on email, or like what happened just a while ago, someone will write a question on a card that's here in the room, and they'll drop it in the box. To the best of my knowledge, there's a little over 70 questions that are in this box, which at the rate we're going is incredible job security for me. So keep it coming. Last week, we didn't even pull from the box because we had one lingering over from the week before. We will go to the box here in a moment. Let me also clarify, because somebody was teasing me earlier, and I know they meant it in good spirits, I do not sit around all week studying these questions. All right, I don't know what's in there. I don't know what's going to come out. That's not to say that I'm smart. The reason is I want us to do this journey together. And so we'll just go for it. So here we go. We'll shake it up. See what comes out. Question number one. It says, I've been praying for someone I know to be healed. I know God is able because he spoke of having faith as a mustard seed. Why do you think God is not healing them? It's a great question. Turn to Matthew chapter 17. Matthew chapter 17 is where this passage is derived from. Let me give you kind of a little background before we get to it. I believe it's verse 20 that is the verse about the faith of a mustard seed. I could be wrong about that, but I know it's in chapter 17. Matthew chapter 17 begins with what we know as the Mount of Transfiguration. Jesus takes Peter, James, and John up on the mountain. You remember the experience. Jesus turns as white as snow, literally before them, as bright as the sun. But in that experience, there are two people that are standing on either side of Jesus. There is Moses and there is Elijah. Remember, Peter puts his foot in his mouth, surprise, and says, Jesus, this is so good. Why don't we build three tabernacles up here for all of you and just kind of hang out? Jesus makes the statement, no, we need to go back down the hill. When they go back down the hill, they find themselves in a situation where there is a man who has a young boy, if I'm not mistaken, who is demon possessed. And he is throwing himself into the fire. When Jesus approaches him and he says, Jesus, this boy of mine is not healed. Your disciples tried to, but they could not. What we see here is the famous phrase, actually it's in verse 21, that says these come out only by prayer and fasting. But prior to that, Jesus makes a statement in regards to his ability versus their inability. Matthew chapter 17. Get there real quickly. Verse 20. And Jesus said unto them, because of your unbelief, why was he not healed? For verily I say unto you, if you have faith as the grain of a mustard seed, you shall say unto this mountain, remove hence to yonder place, and it shall remove. And nothing shall be impossible for you. Now, before we get to the question that was actually asked, I want to take this question and probe a little bit deeper. Why did Jesus say the mustard seed, and why did he use this mountain? He didn't say, if you'll have the faith, that a mountain. He said, this mountain. He was actually very specific to it. Now, the mustard seed, and I'm sure many of you are familiar with this, as far as its physical space or mass, is the smallest of seeds in what we know as the Middle East, and one of the smallest seeds in all of the world. Yet, when it grows to its full fruition, it is a massive, massive plant. So obviously Jesus is using the illustration that if you just have a small amount of faith, mighty things can come of it. But he also says, if you say unto this mountain, and it shall be taken down. I want to take you to the book of Revelation chapter 12, and then we'll come back to Matthew 17. And I promise we will get to the practicality of this question regarding why is it that some that we pray for are healed, and that could be ourselves, and some are not. In Revelation chapter 12, by the way, Revelation 12 is one of those parenthetical chapters. I've used that word with y'all before. It's not in the strict chronology of all the accounts of the book of Revelation. It's almost taken out of the time frame and gives us an oversight or an overview of all the events that are happening at the end times, the book of Revelation. In chapter 12, just in summary, you have the people of God, you have the Israelites who are being chased by the beast, the Antichrist. This is in a time period that almost everybody will agree with is at the very end of the end of the end. I mean, we're getting real close to Jesus coming back when this passage takes place at the end of chapter 12. It says in verse 13 that when the dragon, who is Satan, saw that he was cast into the earth, he persecuted the woman, that is Israel, the people of God, which brought forth the man-child. And to the woman were given two wings of a great eagle, that she might fly into the wilderness in her place, where she is nourished for a time and times and half a time from the face of the serpent. And the serpent cast out of his mouth water as a flood after the woman, that he might cause her to be carried away of the flood. And the earth helped the woman, and the earth opened her mouth and swallowed up the flood which the dragon cast out of his mouth. The idea, the picture that you get here is that this group of people, these Israelites, the people of God, they are running or they are fleeing from Satan during this time known as the tribulation. They find themselves, for lack of better terms, hemmed up by the geography that is around them. And that supernaturally and miraculously, the earth opens up and they are allowed a physical escape. What did Jesus say back in Matthew chapter 17? If you have the faith of a mustard seed, you can say to this mountain, move, and it will move. Now, if you've ever been in the area of Israel, it is incredibly mountainous. Everywhere you go is mountainous. Everywhere you travel, there's mountains, all, particularly in the south end. And the context that you get here in chapter 12 is fleeing to the wilderness, that they were in this region of which then the earth moved. Now, here's the exciting thing, what Jesus was saying. We're going to get practical. Jesus was actually telling a group of Jewish people that there's going to come a day where Satan himself is going to chase after them, and that if they will just have the smallest of faith, when they ask the mountain to move, God will literally move the mountain and the water will go through it and they will be preserved and they will be saved. That's the literal illustration Jesus is using. Now, in my own personal life, I have never had to look at a large mound of dirt and say, I need you to move, please. But my family has looked at cancer and said, we need you to move, please. We've looked at heart disease and said, we need you to move, please. We've looked at financial duress and said, we need you to move, please. We have looked at that first baby that comes home and you don't have a clue what you're doing and say, God, I need you to move, please. I don't have a clue what's going on here. We've had those experiences in life that are not literal mountains, but they are figurative mountains. And Jesus makes the statement, if you have the faith of the mustard seed, then say unto it, and it shall move. So why did I take all that time to explain it? The reason I took all that time is Jesus was not saying every time you have a problem and you pray, it always is answered the way you expect it to be. He was specifically speaking to a specific prophetic example in the future, which he was saying is if he can take a mountain and turn it into a chasm, then he can take cancer and put it into remission. If he can take a mountain and put a hole in the ground, then he can take a broken bone and heal it literally overnight. Well, he was giving us this illustration because in the context of the story, what do we have happening? We have a little boy who is demon possessed. We have a little boy who's thrown himself into the fire and nobody can seem to solve it. But who? Jesus. What was the faith that was displayed? This man came and said, please, Jesus, help me out. And he uses this illustration. Now, to the specifics of the question, why is it that sometimes it is answered and sometimes it is not? Here's my four-word answer. I do not know. I am not God, but I know him well. And one of the things that I've had to learn, and I know compared to most of you, or not most of you, but some of you, I'm not the most mature in physical of years. But in my short time frame, oftentimes the mountains that I wish the Lord would have moved for me, that when I get to the other side after walking around it, I thank him that he kept it where it was. Because I would not have become the person I was if I had had the mountain removed versus having to walk around it or through it or over it or whatever illustration you want to give. Now, I know what you may be thinking, but the things that we're praying for, wouldn't it be great? Wouldn't it be great if God healed them? Oh, the testimony if God would heal them. Oh, the testimony if they would stay faithful if he doesn't. And that's not saying, oh, Jeff, that's easy for you to say. You're nice and healthy. What about my friend who is not? Hey, I'm telling you what, I have been there in the hospital. I've been there when the doctor has come out. And I've told you I'm an only child, so I'm sitting there. We've got people around, but he calls my mom and I aside. I've been there where he says, here's the deal. We did the heart surgery. Everything went exactly as we expected. It went great. But you do know that your husband and your dad is diabetic. We have him fixed, but because he's diabetic, we can't get him to quit bleeding. We have about 2 hours to find out if he lives or not. I've been there. I've been there where you're going, God, wow, seminary didn't solve this one. You know, I've been there where you prayed for somebody to be healed and you got the straight line on the buzzer. I've been there where you prayed for things to be absolved and they were not. Having not necessarily been in your exact shoes or whomever wrote this specific question, when my dad did make it through that surgery, which I'm very grateful for, oftentimes the things that are the mountains in the life of one's life are for somebody else's faith to grow, not just for the, quote, wonderfulness of the person going through the problem. Which is why I believe the Apostle Paul said, I count it all joy. Now, you know, when he said that, he was in prison. He had been falsely accused. This is in Philippians chapter 4, by the way, verses 13 and 14. He had been falsely accused. He had been malnourished. He had been beaten. And he was about to have his head cut off. And he said, I count all things joy. And so the question, it's a difficult question because it's a real life question. But at the same time, I think what we need to understand is that the Lord's answer is sometimes yes, sometimes no, and sometimes wait. But will we have the opinion of giving him glory no matter what his answer may be? Follow-ups, concerns, thoughts? Go for it, sir. Yes, sir. Yes. Right. Okay. Right. The question is, and this is a great question, earlier in the ministry of Jesus, he had sent the disciples out two by two. And he said, wherever you go, and he said, you will have power over all demonic, you'll have power over all authority, etc. And basically they came back and they marveled that even the demons shuddered at their words. And yet here, why is this? And I think, if I'm not mistaken, the passage said the boy was of a lunatic spirit. Is that what it says? Yeah, it was a lunatic spirit, foaming at the mouth, throwing himself into the fire. What did Jesus say in verse 21, though? These come out by prayer and fasting. You almost get the idea that Jesus was saying that sometimes you get to such a spiritual, demonic nature that the only solution in the world is prayer. That's it. And fasting. Of course, it matches those together, obviously. Now, the other question, and you didn't bring this up, but I'm going to, is how many times, and by the way, I've done this and I advocate it, I promote it to the hills. When there are situations where people are ill, they are sick, they are struggling, whatever it is, I encourage prayer, obviously. I mean, we pray over people, we anoint them with oil, we do all that stuff. James 5 says, dude, we do it. But also, there are times where you say, I tell you what, let's get a group together in 3 days, 5 days, a week. Let's pray and fast and then address the situation. But sometimes you've got to be prayed and fasted up when it comes to you. And I think kind of the great practical lesson in this passage is that the disciples were not ready in season and out of season. That season that you're mentioning where they went two by two, they had been with Jesus, studying with Jesus. In our terminology, they were prayed up and ready to go, and nothing stopped them. We don't know all the background here, but is it possible or could it be that this was out of season for them, but Jesus was always in season? Does that help at all? Because sometimes you have a week to gather together and pray, and sometimes it just walks in the door, and you better be ready. But it's a great follow-up on that, because he did say you have all power over all these entities. Follow-up, questions, thoughts, issues? Did I see somebody? I didn't. Oh, it can't be. We're going to get to a second question? No, that's not our style. Here we go. Let's go. I wasn't going to ask for a second opportunity. Question number two. It's a simple question. Why do we worship on Sunday? I answered this Sunday night. Go watch the film. I'm kidding. No. I really did answer the question. But just for a simple rehash, if you were not with us Sunday night, the reason that we worship on Sunday is more tradition than it is anything else. As you study throughout the New Testament, there are times where it says, and they got together on the first day of the week. But you do not see anywhere in the New Testament that only the first day of the week was reserved for worship services. In fact, in 1 Corinthians chapter 11, where it's talking about the Lord's Supper, it says, do this as often as you meet. Sometimes that's multiple times. Sometimes, by the way, and just to give you a little history here, what we know as the Great Plains or the Great Prairie Revivals of the early 1800s up in Missouri and Kentucky and some of those incredible revival movements, because they had what are called circuit rider preachers. You all heard of circuit riders? Circuit riders, back in those days, they were on horses, and they would go from town A to town B to town C, and they would go to these different places, and they would hold worship services. Oftentimes, your community where you lived was so remote, you didn't have a worship service, but maybe once a month. Or maybe it was once every 2 or 3 months, and it was whenever he was there. You had the opportunity to take advantage of it. I use the illustration on Sunday night, that there are communities, particularly in heavily persecuted parts of the world, where they meet almost every night of the week for nightly encouragement. So as often as you meet. Why do we typically worship on Sunday? It is because in 313 A.D., there was a Roman emperor by the name of Constantine who married what we know as Christianity and the Roman Empire. When he did that, basically all of the old Roman pagan holidays, festivals, and such were Christianized in one declare of the pen. And because every week they would worship in a false worshiping mentality on Sunday, their false Roman gods, they declared Sunday, because it was also the day of Jesus' resurrection, as the official weekly worship service of the church. So, Sunday worship is strictly traditional, but at the same time, so is Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, and et cetera throughout the week. So that's a real simple answer of why typically people worship on Sunday. Most people think it's because that's the morning that Jesus rose from the dead. It may be, but that is not why Sunday regular worship was instituted. So, any follow-up? Yes, sir. Yes. Right. What he's referring to is there are other faith systems, other denominations even, that claim that we should continue to worship on Saturday because it is the Sabbath. Now, the Sabbath is strictly, in a Jewish context, is from sundown Friday to sundown Saturday. Those of you that have been to Israel, you have met a Sabbath elevator or a Sabbat elevator. And in fact, that you were not even allowed in Israel on the Sabbath to push the button because that would be working. Now, if you've ever been on the 12th floor of a hotel in Israel on the Sabbath, it's a long journey down. Because the elevator, and those of you that have been there will testify, I didn't make this stuff up, it goes down to floor number 11, and it opens up. It closes, it goes down to 10, it opens up. Why? So that nobody will have to work on the Sabbath day. All right? The Sabbath is from sundown to sundown, Friday to Saturday. However, typically, even in Israel today, they typically begin to practice the Sabbath about 5 p.m. Why? Because of time changes and different seasons and such. They just don't want to get caught coming home from work when it's dark. So they shut down everything early on Friday, obviously into Saturday. Now, the reason that is important is there are some that even would be called Christian denominations that state that we need to continue to worship on the Sabbath. Turn to the book of Exodus, and I believe it's chapter 32. I could be mistaken here. Remember, the Ten Commandments are given to us in chapter 20. And then the Lord, through Moses, begins to explain these commandments. And I have heard people who were not necessarily in favor of how we as a church would do our worship service times on Sunday come to me and say, do you believe in the Ten Commandments? I say, absolutely. They say, why do you only practice 9 of them? And what they're meaning is, we would advocate not to covet, we'd advocate not to murder, but we don't, quote, worship on the Sabbath day, to, quote, keep it holy. And they say, why only 9, why not 10? Well, in Exodus chapter, it's chapter 31, forgive me, verse 12, the Lord spoke unto Moses, saying, speak thou also unto the children of Israel, saying, verily, my Sabbaths, notice the plurality there. By the way, those who advocate worshiping on Saturday, I've never really seen many that utilize the full Sabbath schedule, because there are multiple Sabbaths. It says, verily, my Sabbath you shall keep. Listen to this next phrase. It is a sign between you and me. Now, I want you to help me out here because, you know, sometimes I struggle in English. It is a sign between you and me. Now, who is the me here in this story? It's God. Okay, we got that. That's the easy part. Who is the you? Who said everybody? It says Israel. The word Israel is there. Unto the children of Israel. This is a sign between you and me. It very specifically says it is a sign, and it very explicitly says it's between Israel and God. Now, let's go further. Go to 1 Corinthians chapter 1. We're going to get to about verses 19 and 20, I believe. 1 Corinthians 1. We'll begin in verse 18, one of my favorite verses in the Bible. It says, for the preaching of the cross is to them that perish foolishness, but unto us which are saved, it is the power of God. And yes, one day when I write my book on all the great buts of the Bible, that will be one of the verses. Verse 19, for it is written, I will destroy the wisdom of the wise. I will bring to nothing the understanding of the prudent. Where is the wise? Where is the scribe? Where is the disputer of this world? Hath not God made foolish the wisdom of this world? For after that, in the wisdom of God, the world by wisdom knew not God. It pleased God by the foolishness of preaching to save them that believe. Listen to verse 22. For the Jews require a sign. The Greeks seek after wisdom. But we preach Christ crucified, unto the Jews a stumbling block, etc., etc. Now, let me take you back to Matthew chapter 12. Matthew chapter 12, beginning at about verses 38, 39, 40, etc. There's a group of Jewish people who gather around Jesus and they say, show us a sign. Do you notice the commonality here? It is a sign between Israel and God. The Jews require a sign. What I would say to your question, sir, is that that strict Sabbath day worship is a sign between God and Israel. That entity, Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, 12 tribes, etc. You say, what is a sign? Because we say that all the time. Oh, a sign here, a sign there. Actually, a sign in the Bible doesn't show up a whole lot. Let me give you some instances of a sign. The rainbow is called a sign. When Noah gets off the boat, the rainbow goes in there. That's called a sign. Remember the story about putting the fleece out in the night and the dew being on the fleece and off the ground and vice versa the next? That is called a sign. Behold, a virgin shall give birth. That's a sign. A sign is only something that can directly be attributed to God. There is no way to manufacture it. There's no way to make it up. There is no way for humanity to imitate it, mock it, or do anything to just resemble it. We cannot create a rainbow in the sky. We cannot make it to where the dew falls everywhere but on a blanket in the middle of the field. We cannot do that. But God can. The only sign that Jesus gives in the Gospels is the sign of Jonah. As 3 days in the belly of the whale, so the Son of Man will be in the heart of the earth 3 days and three nights. The only sign he gives is his resurrection. Hello, we can't pull that one off. We can pull off resuscitation, where someone is physically dead, and through the brilliance of medical science can bring them back to life, but what's going to eventually happen down the road? They're not brought back to immortality. Okay, we're thankful they're brought back, but it's not forever. That being said, the Jews require a sign. It's a sign between Israel and me. Let's think about the Sabbath day for just a moment. Because the Sabbath day was not even instituted until after they came out of Egypt. They came out of Egypt. They go across the Red Sea. They go 11 days in the wilderness. Remember what happens? They start griping and saying, oh, if we just were back in Egypt, at least we'd have three meals a day. What happens? 40 years, right? 40 years in the wilderness. Do y'all remember what happened every morning in the wilderness? They would get up, they would go outside of their tents, and the Krispy Kreme truck drove up every single day. Y'all question that, but what does the Bible call manna? It calls it round, sweet, and a little off-white and brownish. Sounds like a donut to me. That's all I got to say. But it says the Lord brought the donut. brought the manna. Sorry. Just kidding. Remember what the Lord said. That everybody go out and get what you need every day, right? Get what you need. What would happen to the manna the next morning if they tried to keep it over? Spoiled. All right? But what happened on Friday morning? They would go out and the Lord said, get what you need for 2 days. And when they came back, they would eat what they needed on Friday. The Sabbath would begin Friday night. It could not commence until late Saturday night. How are you going to eat on Saturday? Because the manna spoils every day, right? Except on the Sabbath. It was able to survive. So when he says it is a sign between you and me, understand the context of Exodus chapter 31 is the wilderness, the seventh day, Israel and God, and a sign. Now, I respect and understand the Ten Commandments are the Ten Commandments. Yes. Should we have a time and a day where we have a Sabbath? Absolutely. But the strict adherence of that day for a New Testament Christian is not doctrinally such, because though we may be spiritual Israel, we are not doctrinal Israel. We are not Jews looking after a sign in an eventual Messiah. We already have a Messiah, and we're looking, according to Titus 2, we're looking for the blessed hope, which is Jesus coming out of the sky. And so that kind of, I hope that helps you, sir, with that question about the Sabbath. Now, if somebody says, well, you know what? I just think that we need to worship on that time period. I don't have a problem with that, as long as they're not doing it thinking that the church has replaced Israel. See, sir, one of the things you didn't bring up is oftentimes those who believe that you should only worship on that time period take all the prophecies to Israel and insert the church in there, and they believe that the church has replaced Israel. We have not replaced Israel. We are, according to the New Testament, we are the wild grafted in branch into Israel. We're the wild berries, thankfully connected to the vine. Does that help your question about the Sabbath? Anything else about Sabbath? Yes, ma'am. That is correct, and I'm glad you brought that up. She said, wasn't the Sabbath a day of rest, not a day of worship? The typical Jewish Sabbath observation is that when the sun sets on Friday, they gather in their community, their synagogue and such, and they have a worship time and a reading of the Torah on Friday evening. And then Saturday is a time period of complete rest. Now, here's the thing, because I believe in the concept, and by the way, it said Sabbaths, plural. The Sabbath wasn't a time to rest from the exhaustion of the week before. It was a time to prepare for the week that's ahead. How many times have you heard somebody say, I just need a Sabbath? Well, that's actually the wrong perspective. A Sabbath, in principle, is if you know you have something coming up that's extreme, you take time before it to prepare for it, not take time after to recover from it. That's just kind of the spirit of the matter. But you're absolutely correct. And that is why that if you're in a Jewish community, if you're over in Israel, particularly on Friday afternoon, Friday morning, the Jewish families are cooking up a storm. I mean, you're going to think you're back in Baton Rouge. I mean, they're going to town. Why? Because it has got to hold over till Saturday, because you cannot cook on Saturday as a part of the Sabbath observation. You can't walk a certain distance. You cannot do physical exercise, which is why you can't push the button in the elevator in the hotel rooms. By the way, the hotels in Israel, boy, they fill up on Friday night because people want to go there. That way they're not tempted to work at their home. They're in a hotel doing nothing, and I guess watching ESPN, it's not work, so it's all good. So hopefully that helps you with that question. Anything else on that one? Yes, sir. Right. The statement that he's referring to is the one thing that the Jewish community, particularly the Pharisees and the scribes and such, they tried to pin Jesus down on was his lack of Sabbath observation. They were trying, if you want to just take a step back, those who were against Jesus of the Jewish religion, they tried to get him breaking Jewish law. The problem was they never could. So they had a fake trial to accuse him of breaking Roman law, is what they did, even though he didn't do that either. Nonetheless, what you're referring to, sir, is they would come to him and he would heal somebody on the Sabbath. And they'd say, aha, we gotcha. And Jesus' statement was real simple. He said, well, even you, if you have an oxen fall in the ditch, would pick it up Why? Because the Sabbath was not made for man. Man was made for the Sabbath. What Jesus was trying to communicate to them, and even bringing up the fact that David ate corn on the Sabbath once because he was dying of starvation, was that basically doing nothing from sundown to sundown did not make you holy. What made you holy was the allegiance to God that you rested upon on that day. And so what he was saying is, even you guys realize, meaning those that were against him, if you found yourself in a dire strait where in the process of resting, I'm just going to make up an illustration. You have a son that's on a bunk bed. He's taking a nap. He falls off and breaks a leg. You don't let him sit there in agony for 18 hours because it's the Sabbath. You would go and seek attention. You know, and so Jesus said, even you guys, what Jesus was basically saying is, the standard that you're holding me to, you don't even hold yourself. By the way, I'm glad you brought that up, because I want to take you to one of the most misinterpreted passages in all the Bible. Go to Matthew chapter 7, because a lot of times people will quote this way out of context. And sir, you have brought up a good reason with the Sabbath of why to bring it up. Verse 1 of Matthew 7, by the way, we're in the Sermon on the Mount. Jesus says, judge not, lest you be judged. How many times have you had somebody throw that in your face? When you take a stance, when you say that's not right or that is wrong. Someone says, whoa, even Jesus said you shouldn't judge me. Judge not, lest you be judged. Yeah, they need to keep reading. Verse 2, for with what judgment you judge, you shall be judged. With what measure you meet, it shall be measured to you again. Why beholdest thou the mote that's in your brother's eye, but consider not the beam that's in your own eye? Why will you say to your brother, let me pull out the mote of thine eye, and behold, a beam is in your own eye? Thou hypocrite. And it goes on. So I think to your point, sir, what Jesus, or the illustration that Jesus came back to them with was, you're saying that I cannot be who I am because I healed this man, but yet you got somebody's ox out of the ditch last week. That's the same thing. And yet you think you're okay and I'm not, but yet I've healed a man. And you just got an ox out of the ditch. And I think one of the important lessons of that, if there's one thing that Jesus tried to convey to the Pharisees that they could not get, was that they were sinners. They wouldn't admit they were. And he was trying to say is, even you have broken the law. Now, let's say you broke the sabbatical laws. Okay? And let me take this to the extreme. Let's take it to the Passover laws. You know, if you violated the Passover laws the week of Passover, you were not allowed to participate. You go back to the book of Numbers, it tells you that if you found yourself unclean during Passover. Now, how could you find yourself unclean? Well, obviously, there are some natural situations that could occur. But in particular for men, if you handled a dead body. What if your uncle passed away that week? What if your relative, your brother, and you actually handled the body and did what you would do, that you were not allowed to take the Passover with unclean hands? You had to wait 8 days until you could do it. The reason I bring that up is there were cases where you would help an ox out of the ditch or do whatever. Your violating the Sabbath hindered you that day from some things, but did not hinder you from having it made up later. Does that help at all with that situation? All they were doing was trying to trap Jesus. And the thing I loved about Jesus so many times is when they tried to trap him, he'd throw a question right back at him. My favorite one is when they come at him and he says, okay, you want to play dirty. How about John the Baptist? Was that from heaven or was that from man? And remember, they gathered together and they said, if we say it's from heaven, they'll believe Jesus. If we say it's from man, the people are going to revolt against us. We don't have an answer. And then Jesus said, I'm not going to answer you either. Bye. Have a good one. Because they didn't have a belief except for what the people were. Hopefully that helped somewhat. Any others on that issue, roundabout, somewhat, close to? Oh, don't tell me we're going to get to question three. This is scary. Our TV audience is going to be, oh, I knew it. Go ahead. Oh, absolutely. So what he's bringing up is, Jesus used as an illustration that the, quote, professional religious guys, the priests and such, because of the amount of stuff that they did on the Sabbath, were breaking the law in and of itself. Yeah. The whole point of Jesus in relation to the Sabbath law was to show that no matter how good you try to be, you're never good enough. And the thing that I love about whether it's the story of an oxen coming out of the ditch or whether it's the story of a lunatic child that keeps throwing himself with a bad spirit in the fire is every story that Jesus taught or performed or did can be summed up in this. He was getting people to realize they needed him. Apart from him, there was no righteousness and there was no favor with God. They needed him desperately. And sometimes he utilized a rhetoric with the Pharisees over the Sabbath. Sometimes he used the healing of the demonic child. Whatever. All right, question number three. Mix them up here. Now, you know it's a good question when someone begins it with, okay. I just read them as they're written, okay? Okay. Someone asked me this question yesterday regarding tithing. In Malachi 3, where it talks about the tithe being 10%, does that go to the church itself? What if you do not attend church regularly? Can you tithe 10% to another Christian organization, charity, etc.? Or is that considered an offering? All right. Boy, now this is a question that will get some people upset. Because it seems like that every time I address this issue, somebody says, you know what, every time I come to church, y'all are talking about money. No, it just happens that the Lord's trying to convict you when you're at church. Okay, so let's go to Malachi chapter 3. This is a great question. Because there are... Okay, before we get to... go ahead and go to Malachi chapter 3. But let me share with you the facts of the matter in regards to tithing. In the Old Testament, there are actually three tithes. I don't know if you know that, but there are. The three tithes go a little something like this. The first tithe was a 10% that went into, as you read Malachi chapter 3, verse 10 in specific, the first 10% goes into the quote-unquote storehouse. That was, for lack of better terms, that was the Jewish temple that allowed for the, you know, everything for the veil to be mended, to the sacrifices to be there, for the temple. I mean, everything to be as it needed to be, take care of the priests, the Levites, all that such. That's where the first 10% went to the storehouse. There's also a second tithe mentioned in the Old Testament. The second 10% was to be set aside for religious celebrations. There were seven feasts in the Jewish year. Everything from Passover to the Feast of Tabernacles to the Feast of Unleavened Bread, all these different things, that they were actually to set aside 10% of what was left over so that they did not have an excuse for missing it. Now, this comes into play in the life of Jesus. Remember when he's 12 years of age and they go into Jerusalem? And his parents go back with the family and they realize the next day they've, quote, lost him. And they go back and he says, did you not know that I would be in my father's house, etc.? But in that story, it says they went as they did every year. Now, let's just be honest as a bunch of good church-going Gentiles. Every one of us, I am going to presume, as grown adults, has had a time in our life where finances were not the best and we didn't get to go on the vacation we'd hoped to that year. Everybody got a hand up on that one? You didn't have that privilege as a Jewish person with Passover, particularly the Feast of Tabernacles. Most people don't realize, even though Passover is the big holiday or the big celebration, all males who had been through what we know as a bar mitzvah and above, basically were man or a man, were mandatory to go to the Feast of Tabernacles every fall. They could not miss at all to be a Jew in good standing. Now, you say, well, how did they do this? How did even Jesus, now I know he was the Son of God, Son of Man, I get that. But his earthly dad was a carpenter that would not have been very wealthy. And his earthly mother was a homemaker, obviously no physical income. They were known as being somewhat poor. How did they afford to go to Jerusalem every single year? I'll tell you how. Is because they put the second 10% of whatever they made selling whatever his dad sold into this fund so that they didn't miss it. The third tithe was actually given every third year. Every third year you gave an additional 10% that went to the poor. Don't you remember in the ministry of Jesus when the woman comes with the ointment of oil and pours it upon Jesus' body and Judas of all people? It says, but Jesus, this could have been used for the poor. What did Jesus say? You always have the poor with you. Was he basically saying, I don't care about poor people, this is more important? No. What Jesus was saying is, God's already set aside how to take care of them. It should be there, but they had often misappropriated it. That doesn't happen in our contemporary world, does it? No, never happens. God had a system set up for this to happen. So let's just use simple math here. Let's just say, simple math, that the annual income of this Jewish family, once again, simple math, was $10,000. That's because I cannot divide real numbers in real time in front of a live audience. 10,000. So the first 10%, or 1,000, would go directly to the temple. The next 10%, how much is left? 9,000. The next $900, if we do our math, would be set aside to go to the religious feast. And then for those who'd been through Dave Ramsey's Financial Peace University, they would take actually about 3.33% of what was left over and put it aside every however they needed, because every third year they were to give 10% of that third 10% to the poor. So there would be an amount that would be given right here. Sometimes they do it every third, etc. So the reason I bring that up is because there are some people, and they're gaining a lot of voice today, that say, well, you know, that tithing stuff, that's not for the Christian. That's Old Testament. And if you're really going to tithe, you need to do all three. Well, I understand the logic in that. I also understand the logic in this, that we do not have a temple system. We do not have daily sacrifices. We do not have Levites that have been set aside as a tribe of Israel. I realize that. But here's what you do see. Not only in Malachi chapter 3 is it still there, but Jesus never spoke against it. I mean, don't you think if tithing was so bad, Jesus would have said, now guys, love your neighbor as yourself, but forget the tithing stuff, that's out of date. He never did that, did he? In fact, if you'll turn to Matthew chapter 23, I know I alluded to Malachi 3:10, we didn't read it. But prior to that, in verse 8, the Lord makes this question, or this rhetorical question. He's saying that the people are robbing him. You say, how are we robbing you? You're robbing me of the tithe. Basically, the Lord was telling the Israelites, specifically the priests, hey, you want to know why our relationship isn't good right now? Because you're not doing what you're supposed to be doing. If you don't do what you're supposed to be doing, I'm not going to do what I'm supposed to be doing. This is an agreement. Matthew chapter 23, once again, to the religious leaders of his day. Verse 23. Matthew 23:23. Woe unto you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites! You pay the tithe of mint, anise, and cumin, and have omitted the weightier matters of the law, judgment, mercy, faith. These ought you have done, and not to leave the other undone. Was Jesus saying, forget tithing, just be kind to one another? No. He said, your problem is you're doing one, you're not doing the other. They prided themselves that these wealthy men in the community, they gave 10%, but they were not kind, merciful, etc. Jesus is saying, it's not either or, it's both and. When you get through the Gospels, nowhere, any place in the Gospels does Jesus ever say, outdated, shouldn't do it, never mind. When you get to the letters of the Apostle Paul, I'll be honest with you, the word tithing is nowhere found in the letters of Paul. It's not there. It's not there. And there are people who will say, well, since tithing's never mentioned much in the Gospels, and it's not mentioned hardly at all in the writings of Paul, then you know what? We shouldn't do it anymore. The problem was that Paul did say in 1 Corinthians 8 to give of a cheerful heart and to give abundantly. Now, the way I read that is this. The goal is not 10%. The goal is to start at 10%. Because the last time I checked, Jesus gave me 100. The least I can do is a portion of that back. Now, let me tell you the two extremes in our culture. One extreme is we have a group of people here, what I call the anti-tithers. There are people who say, we shouldn't do it. It was for the Jews only. It's not called a sign like the Sabbath. Okay? It's just for them. We don't have a temple. Shouldn't do it. But by the way, they were also, the Jewish people still tithe even though they don't have a temple. So don't get stuck on the building. So it's not for the New Testament Christians. Shouldn't do it at all. That's the anti-tithers. On the other side of the equation, we have this group today, what I call the hyper-tithers. They believe that if you hold your wallet up in church and pray over it, you'll be blessed tenfold for what you give. I give 10 so I can get 100. Those are the hyper tithers. Can I tell you where the answer is? Right in the middle. Now, It says that even when they were giving to the storehouse in Malachi 3, they were giving to the Lord. Now, let me tell you a phrase that just, I don't say it vocally when somebody comes up to me, but it just makes the hair on the back of my neck just stand straight up when someone says this. And they mean it sincerely. How do I pay my tithe? You don't pay a tithe. That's a tax. You give a tithe. You give it. Now, back in Malachi chapter 3, I realized it was the temple and I realized it was the Israelites. But it said that by not doing it, you would be cursed. You know, I just don't want to play around with that. Because life isn't perfect. Have y'all figured that out yet? Life isn't perfect. And I'm just going to be honest with you. I'm not as dumb as I look, but I'm not as sharp as I should be. And there are times that I make some really poor decisions in life. And there are times I do some really dumb things. We all do that, right? Here's the great news. When there are things in my life that are happening, sometimes they're inconsequential. Sometimes they're not for anything I've done. But it is so wonderful to put my head down on the pillow at night in the midst of trouble and say, well, Lord, at least this isn't because I robbed you. I mean, think about that for just a moment. Do you know what a relief that is? And one of the things that I've discovered when you give to God, that somehow, supernaturally, it just works. Let me tell you, my best friend in college in my young adult years is an accountant. He's a CPA. He's a financial whiz. He's a CFO of some billion-dollar company. I mean, to him, if the number doesn't have two or three commas in it, he never uses it. I mean, they're huge numbers, big guy, not big physically, but with number stuff. I remember when we first got out of college. I remember when we first started, you know, quote, getting out on our own. And I didn't know a whole lot about money at the time, and so I would go to him. I'd say, hey, can you help me out with my budget here? I mean, you got a master's degree in accounting. Surely you can help me budget my checkbook. I mean, we can do this, right? And I remember, here's what we would do, is I would put my income down. I'd put it down, and in the first column, there would be my tithe. And then we'd go through everything I needed to go. At the end of the year, I would have a negative balance. And he would look at me and say, Jeff, you do realize that that's not supposed to be negative down here. And I'd say, yes, I do. But then he would always say this. Now, I didn't tell you that he's also the son of a pastor. He would always look at me and say, but Jeff, because you did that, I got a feeling there's not going to be a minus sign down there at the end. And there never has been. I don't know how God does it. I don't understand it. It's like manna. It just shows up. And sometimes it is in the form of currency. Sometimes it's in the form of favors. Sometimes it's in the form of, I should have broken something and gone to the hospital and I didn't. Thank you, Lord. You know, however that works out. And so, just speaking personally to you, I don't just believe in it. I really believe in it. And I just believe, I don't give so God will give back. That's not why I give. I give so that I can be more like him. He's giving. I need to be giving too. And if I spend my life being selfish, I really don't want God being selfish with me. That's not a good position. Now, the question said, does it go to the local church, go to ministry, such? Here's the deal. That as a born-again believer in Jesus Christ, you should be giving to the Lord. What is the best and seamless and easiest way to do that? It is through one's local church. Now, that being said, what if one has just recently moved? Or what if they get displaced? What if their church? You're giving to the Lord. Okay? It can be another church. It can be whatever it is. The struggle that I have is like in a previous church situation I was in, that I had an individual walking through the foyer of the church make a statement that he wasn't going to give to the church that he was attending. And I said, why? He looked and goes, this church is so big, y'all got enough money, don't need mine. I wanted to say, brother, I do not want to be sleeping under your roof at night. Why? Because obviously he doesn't give to the Lord. He gives to what he wants fortified, whatever that may be. Now, the Bible speaks very clearly of not only giving tithing, but also speaks of offerings. That's why we have the Lottie Moon offering. Annie Armstrong offering. It's above and beyond. You say, why do we have offerings? Don't you remember that Jewish formula there? Basically, what we've done is taken what was instituted in the temple. We've just kind of translated it over and said, so that ministry can happen here, here's where the first 10 goes, here's where the offerings and such. I could tell you story after story after story after story about this. But my favorite one is this one. And just put up with it. If you've heard it from me, just deal with it. I think I shared this with our men's group, our very first meeting. When I was in Mississippi, I was preaching through, and it came to the issue of tithing. And I know some people are hyper, and some people are anti. And I know it doesn't matter what you say on the subject, somebody's going to get upset with you. So you might as well just make everybody mad. That's my opinion. So I'm addressing it, and I had this man come up to me. And he said, you really, truly believe that tithing is supernatural? I said, it's got to be. I said, it's not. It doesn't work in the natural world, only in the supernatural. He said, well, how much you think so? And his name was Reggie. And I said, Reggie, I said, please don't call an attorney on this one. But I would be willing to say that if you started tithing, having never tithed before, I'd be willing to say almost to the point that we'd be willing, I didn't say we would, but we'd almost be willing to the point of giving it back if it didn't work. I didn't say we would. I said we'd almost be willing. You got to check the words that you give there, you know. And he gave me that look like, I don't know what you said, but I know it's not what I thought it was, but I'm going to give it a shot anyway. And so Reggie decided to start tithing. He had never tithed in his life. He was a believer. He sang in a Southern gospel group, sang bass, beautiful voice, but he'd never tithed. So he began. 3, 4, 5 months into it, he would stop by the office. He'd go, Bro Jeff, this is amazing. I said, what? He goes, I don't miss it at all. I said, well, isn't that incredible? So we kept going. A year had gone by. He makes an appointment to meet with me. I'm thinking, this is not good. I'm glad my father-in-law is an attorney. Is he suing me over what he gave? I don't know. So he comes in and he says, here's the deal. He said, I want you to know I gave 10% of everything I made this year. I said, and? He said, I got more money left over than I did in previous years. He said, it's incredible. I said, Brother, I said, I told you it was between you and God, okay? This isn't about accounting. This is about God. 3 weeks later, maybe 4 weeks later, he calls back. He says, are you in your office? He called me on my cell phone. I said, yes, sir. He said, don't leave. I've got to see you. I'm getting nervous at this point, okay? Because the only time we talk is about the subject matter, right? So he comes back to my office. He is, I mean, it's the calf looking at the new gate. Look, you know, he is shocked. He's mesmerized. He says, Pastor Jeff, you didn't tell me. I said, what did I not tell you? You didn't tell me it was tax deductible. I said, well, Reggie, it wasn't a part of the conversation. I said, all we were talking about is being faithful to God, not about taxes. And he held up his tax return, and it was almost to the dollar of what he had given. And he said, nobody will ever talk me out of this again. Now, I haven't seen him in years, and I don't know what's going on in his life. The reason I tell that story is this. He didn't start giving to get. That's not why he was doing it. At the same time, he wasn't giving thinking, if I don't, the roof is going to fall on me tonight. He gave by simply wanting to be faithful to God and let God take care of it. Now, when I pray over an offering, when I have that privilege and opportunity, let me tell you what I pray. I always pray that God will do more with our little than we could do with our lot. Because I believe that God can do more with 90% than Jeff can do with 100%. I believe God can do better with 80% than I can do with 100%. And so when we give, you know, it's easy to get up and say, only trust him, only trust him. Let me tell you what's hard, writing the check. It's easy to say, turn your eyes upon Jesus, look full in his wonderful face. It's hard to write that check when you just got a bill from the doctor. Do we trust him? Our giving to God, I believe, shows more of our trust in God than even our public worship. Because it shows, God, I'm going to trust you with this. So back to the original question, Does it specifically in the New Testament say, as a born-again believer, you are to give 10% to your local church? No, it does not. It does not say that. However, I do believe there is ample evidence that 10% is not the finish line, but the starting line. And that when we give, God takes care of us, God blesses us, and He's good to us. And so my suggestion is to follow the example of the Myers family and just give. What we do is this. Anything that we receive, 10% of it goes right back out, plus some. Every time it seems like I come home, she's got some new ministry she wants to support somewhere, somehow. She's the one that does that. And I'm like, okay, let's go for it, baby. I don't know in our marriage if there's ever been a time where when she felt convicted or I felt convicted to give above, even beyond 10% to something else, that we did not do so. And I hate to do this in front of a television audience, but I've never missed a meal yet. Why? God takes care of us every single time. So hopefully that helps with the question. Any follow-up on that? I know it's always a fun, emotional subject matter. Nobody? Nobody's like, okay. And it's 7:30. We've gone an hour, folks. Hey, we made it through three questions. Congratulations. So we will not put these back in the box. We'll get to it next week. There's still plenty here. Let me give you a suggestion. I don't know when these were submitted. I have no idea. These could have been submitted the first week. They could have been submitted this week. Whoa, there they went. I really don't know. So please do not get caught up in the trap of thinking there are so many in that box. There's no way they'll get to my question. I have no idea what order they will come out. They get shuffled every. Miss Deborah in the office takes them every Wednesday and she shuffles them really good. I have no idea what the order is. Don't have a clue what's in there. So don't think, well, I'm just going to wait because it'll never get to it. Maybe the first one that's actually taken. And if you don't ask it, we may not ever answer it. So keep them coming. Ask Jeff on Facebook, as well as you can send it to Pastor Jeff at gspcla.com. Or if you're here in person, you can write it down, drop it in the box